great deal of money, and offered my hand as payment for the debt.
Ah, so we all have our sufferings.
Her lip twisted in a faint scowl.
My husband always had a good nose for a bargain. His health began to decline soon after we married, and I took a more and more active role in the management of his affairs and those of the guild. By the time he died, I was magister in all but name, and my colleagues were sensible enough to formalize the arrangement. The Spicers have always been more concerned for profit than propriety.
Her eyes flicked up to look at Glockter.
I mean no disrespect, but how does a war hero come to be a torturer?
It was his turn to pause.
A good question. How did that happen?
There are precious few opportunities for cripples.
Ida nodded slowly, her eyes never leaving Glockter's face.
That must have been hard, to come back after all that time in the darkness and to find that your friends had no use for you, to see in their faces only guilt and pity and disgust, to find yourself alone.
Glockter's eyelid was twitching, and he rubbed at it gently. He had never discussed such things with anyone before.
And now here I am, discussing them with a stranger.
There can be no doubt that I'm a tragic figure. I used to be a shit of a man, now I'm a husk of one. Take your pick.
I imagine it makes you sick to be treated that way. Very sick and very angry.
If only you knew.
It still seems a strange decision, though, for the tortured to turn torturer.
On the contrary, nothing could be more natural. In my experience, people do as they are done to. You were sold by your father and bought by your husband, and yet you choose to buy and sell.
Ida frowned.
Something for her to think about, perhaps.
I would have thought your pain would give you empathy.
Empathy? What's that?
Glockter winced as he rubbed at his aching leg.
It's a sad fact, but pain only makes you sorry for yourself.
Chapter 8 Campfire Politics. Logan shifted uncomfortably in his saddle and squinted up at the few birds circling around over the great flat plain. Damn, but his arse hurt. His thighs were sore, his nose was all full of the smell of horse. Couldn't find a comfortable position to put his fruits in. Always squashed, however often he jammed his hand down inside his belt to move them. A damn uncomfortable journey this was turning out to be, in all sorts of ways. He used to talk on the road, back in the north. When he was a boy, he'd talk to his father. When he was a young man, he'd talk to his friends. When he'd followed Bethod, he'd talk to him all the day long, for they'd been close back then, like brothers almost. Talk took your mind off the blisters on your feet, or the hunger in your belly, or the endless bloody cold, or who'd got killed yesterday. Logan used to laugh at the dogman stories while they slogged through the snow. He used to puzzle over tactics with three trees while they rode through the mud. He used to argue with Black Dow while they waded through bogs, and no subject was ever too small. He'd even traded a joke or two with Harding Grimm in his time, and there weren't too many who could say that. He sighed to himself, a long, painful sigh that caught at the back of his throat. Good times, no doubt, but far behind him now, in the sunny valleys of the past. Those boys were all gone back to the mud, all silent forever. Worse yet, they'd left Logan out in the middle of nowhere with this lot. The great Giselle Dan Luther wasn't interested in anyone's stories except his own. He sat stiff upright and aloof the whole time, chin held high, displaying his arrogance and his superiority and his contempt for everything, like a young man might show off his first sword, long before he learned that it was nothing to be proud of. Baez had no interest in tactics.
When he spoke at all, he barked in single words, in yeses and in noes, frowning out across the endless grass like a man who's made a bad mistake and can't see his way clear of it. His apprentice, too, seemed changed since they'd left Adua. Quiet, hard, watchful. Brother Longfoot was away across the plain, scouting out the route. Probably best that way. No one else had any talk at all. The navigator, Logan had to admit, had far too much. Pharaoh rode some distance away from the rest of this friendly gathering, her shoulders hunched, her brows drawn down in a constant scowl, the long scar on her cheek puckered up an angry grey, doing her best to make the others look like a sack of laughs. She leaned forwards into the wind, pushing at it, as if she hoped to hurt it with her face. More fun to trade jokes with the plague than with her, Logan reckoned. And that was the merry band. His shoulders slumped. "How long until we get to the edge of the world?" he asked Baez without much hope. "Some way yet," growled the Magus through barely open teeth. So Logan rode on, tired and sore and bored, and watched those few birds gliding slowly over the endless plain. Nice big fat birds. He licked his lips. "We could do with some meat," he muttered. Hadn't had fresh meat in a good long time now, not since they left Chalcis. Logan rubbed his stomach. The fatty softness from his time in the city was already tightening. "Nice bit of meat." Pharaoh frowned over at him, then up at the few birds circling above. She shrugged her bow off her shoulder. "Ha!" chuckled Logan. "Good luck!" He watched her slide an arrow smoothly out from her quiver. Futile gesture. Even Harding Grimm could never have made that shot, and he was the best man Logan had ever seen with a bow. He watched Pharaoh knock her shaft to the curved wood, back arched, yellow eyes fixed on the gliding shapes overhead. "You'll never bag one of those, not in a thousand years of trying." She pulled back the string. "Waste of a shaft," he shouted. "You've got to be realistic about these things." Probably the arrow would drop back down and stab him in the face, or stick his horse through the neck, so it died and fell over and crushed him under it. A fitting end to this nightmare of a journey. A moment later, one of the birds tumbled down into the grass. Pharaoh's arrow stuck right through it. "No," he whispered, gawping open-mouthed at her as she bent the bow again. Another arrow sailed up into the grey sky. Another bird flopped to the earth just beside the first. Logan stared at it, disbelieving. "No. Don't tell me you haven't seen stranger things," said Baez. "A man who talks to spirits, who travels with Magi, the most feared man in all the North." Logan pulled his horse up and slithered down from the saddle. He walked through the long grass, bent down on wobbly, aching legs, and picked up one of the birds. The shaft had stuck it right through the center of the breast. If Logan had stabbed it with the arrow at a distance of a foot, he could hardly have done it more neatly. "That's wrong." Baez grinned down, hands crossed on the saddle before him. "In ancient days before history, so the legends say, our world and the other side were joined. One world. Demons walked the land, free to do as they pleased. Chaos beyond dreaming. They bred with humans, and their offspring were half-breeds. Part man, part demon. Devil bloods. Monsters. One among them took the name Eos. He delivered humanity from the tyranny of devils, and the fury of his battle with them shaped the land. He split the world above from the world below, and he sealed the gates between. To prevent such terror ever coming again, he pronounced the first law. It is forbidden to touch the other side direct or to speak with devils." Logan watched the others watch Pharaoh. Luthar and Quai, both frowning at this uncanny display of archery.
She leaned right back in her saddle, bowstring drawn as tight as it would go, glittering point of the next shaft held perfectly steady, still managing to nudge her mount this way and that with her heels. Logan could scarcely make a horse do what he wanted with the reins in his hands, but he failed to see what Baez's crazy story had to do with it. Devils and so on. The first law. Logan waved his hand. So what?
From the start, the first law was filled with contradictions. All magic comes from the other side, falling upon the land as the light falls from the sun. Eos himself was part devil, and so were his sons, Juvens, Canadius, Glustrod, and others beside. Their blood brought them gifts and curses, power and long life, and strength or sight beyond the limits of simple men. Their blood passed on into their children, growing ever thinner into their children's children, and so on through the long centuries. The gift skipped one generation, then another, then came but rarely. The devil blood grew thin and died out. It is rare indeed now, when our world and the world below have drifted so far apart, to see those gifts made flesh. We truly are privileged to witness it.
Logan raised his eyebrows.
Her? Half-devil?
Much less than half, my friend, Baez chuckled. Eos himself was half, and his power threw up the mountains and gouged out the seas. Half could strike a horror and a desire into your blood to stop your heart. Half could blind you to look upon. Not half, no more than a fraction. But in her there is a trace of the other side.
The other side, eh?
Logan looked down at the dead bird in his hand.
So, if I was to touch her, would I break the first law?
Baez chuckled.
Now that is a sharp question. You always surprise me, Master Ninefingers. I wonder what Eos would say to it.
The Magus pursed his lips.
I think I could find it in myself to forgive you. She, however, and Baez nodded his bald head at Pharaoh, would most likely cut your hand off.
Logan lay on his belly, peering through the tall grass into a gentle valley with a shallow brook in its bottom. There was a huddle of buildings on the side nearest them, or the shells of buildings. No roofs left, nothing but the tumble-down walls, mostly no more than waist-high, the fallen stones from them scattered across the valley's slopes in amongst the waving grass. It could have been a scene out of the north. Lots of villages abandoned there since the wars. People driven out, dragged out, burned out. Logan had watched it happen, often. He'd joined in more than once. He wasn't proud of it, but he wasn't proud of much from those times. Or any other, come to think of it.
Not a lot left to live in, whispered Luthar.
Pharaoh scowled at him.
Plenty left to hide behind.
Evening was coming on. The sun had dropped low on the horizon and filled the broken village up with shadows. There was no sign of anyone down there. No sounds beyond the giggling water, the slow wind slithering through the grass. No sign of anyone. But Pharaoh was right. No sign didn't necessarily mean no danger.
"You had best go down there and take a look," murmured Longfoot.
"I best?" Logan glanced sideways at him. "You're staying here, then, eh?"
"I have no talent for fights. You are well aware of that."
Muttered Logan. "No talent for the sorting of fights. Plenty for the finding of them, though."
"Finding things is what I do. I'm here to navigate."
"Maybe you could find me a decent meal and a bed to sleep in," snapped Luthar in his whining Union accent.
Pharaoh sucked her teeth with disgust.
"Someone's got to go," she growled, sliding over the lip of the slope on her belly. "I'll take the left."
No one else moved.
"Us too," Logan grunted at Luthar.
"Me?
Who else? Three's a good number. Let's go and let's keep it stealthy." Luthar peered through the grass into the valley, licked his lips, rubbed his palms together. Nervous, Logan could tell. Nervous, but proud at the same time, like an untried boy before a battle, trying to show he's not scared by sticking his chin out. Logan wasn't fooled. He'd seen it all 100 times before.
"You planning to wait for the morning?" he grunted.
"Just keep your mind on your own shortcomings, Northman," hissed Luthar as he started to wriggle forward down the slope. "You've enough of them."
The rowels of his big, shiny spurs rattled loud as he dragged himself over the edge, clumsy and unpracticed, his arse sticking up in the air. Logan grabbed hold of his coat before he got more than a stride.
"You're not leaving those on, are you?" "What?" "Those fucking spurs. Stealthy, I said. You might as well hang a bell off your cock."
Luthar scowled as he sat up to pull them off.
"Stay down," hissed Logan, pushing him back into the grass on his back. "You want to get us killed? Get off me."
Logan shoved him down again, then stabbed at him with his finger to make sure he got the point.
"I'm not dying over your fucking spurs, and that's a fact. If you can't keep quiet, you can stay here with the navigator."
He glowered over at Longfoot.
"Maybe you both can navigate your way into the village once we've made sure it's safe."
He shook his head and crawled down the slope after Pharaoh. She was already halfway to the brook, rolling and slithering over the crumbled walls, sneaking across the spaces in between them, keeping low, hand on the grip of her curved sword, quick and silent as the wind over the plain. Impressive, no doubt, but Logan was nobody's fool when it came to a spot of sneaking. He'd been known for it when he was younger. Lost count of the number of Shankar, the number of men he'd come up behind. The first you'll hear of the Bloody Nine is the blood hissing out of your neck. That used to be the rumor. Say one thing for Logan Ninefingers, say that he's stealthy. He flowed up to the first wall, slid one leg over it, silent as a mouse. He lifted himself up, smooth as butter, keeping quiet, keeping low. His back foot caught on a set of loose stones, dragged them scraping with him. He grabbed at them, fumbled them, knocked over even more with his elbow, and they clattered down loud around him. He stumbled onto his weak ankle, twisted it, squawked with pain, fell over, and rolled through a patch of thistles.
"Shit!"
he grunted, struggling up, one hand clutching at the hilt of his sword, all tangled up with his coat. Good thing he hadn't had it out, or he could have stuck himself through with it. Happened to a friend of his. So busy shouting that he tripped on a tree root and cut a big piece out of his head on his own axe. Back to the mud double time. He crouched among the fallen stones, waiting for someone to jump him. No one came. Just the wind breathing through the gaps in the old walls, the water chuckling away in the brook. He crept along beside a heap of rough stones, through an old doorway, slithered over a slumping wall, limping and gasping on his bad foot, scarcely making any effort to stay quiet any longer. There was no one there. He'd known it as soon as he fell. No way they could have missed that sorry performance. The dog man would most likely have been weeping right about now, had he been alive. He waved up at the ridge, and a moment later, he saw Longfoot stand up and wave as well. "No one here," he muttered to himself.
"Just as well," hissed Pharaoh's voice, not more than a stride or two behind. "You've got a new way of scouting, Pink. Make so much noise that they come to you."
"Out of practice," grunted Logan.
"Still, no harm done. No one here."
"There was." She was standing in the shell of one of the ruined buildings, frowning down at the ground. A burned patch in the grass, a few stones set around it, a campfire. "No more than a day or two old," muttered Logan, poking at the ashes with a finger. Luthar walked up behind them.
"No one here, after all."
He had a smug, sucked-in look on his face, like he'd somehow been right about something all along. Logan didn't see what.
"Lucky for you there isn't, or we might be stitching you together right about now."
"I'd be stitching the fucking pair of you," hissed Pharaoh. "I ought to stitch your useless pink heads together. You're both as worthless as a bag of sand in the desert." "There's tracks over there. Horses. More than one cart."
Merchants, maybe? Asked Logan, hopefully. He and Pharaoh looked at each other for a moment.
Might be better if we stay off the track from now on.
Too slow.
Baez had made it down into the village now. Quai and Longfoot weren't far behind with the cart and the horses.
Far too slow. We stick to the track. We'll see anyone coming in good time out here. Plenty of time.
Luthar didn't look convinced.
If we see them, they'll see us. What then?
Then?
Baez raised an eyebrow.
Then we have the famous Captain Luthar to protect us.
He looked round at the ruined village.
Running water and shelter of a kind. Seems like a good place to camp.
Good enough, muttered Logan, already rooting through the cart for logs to start a fire of their own. I'm hungry. What happened to those birds?
Logan sat and watched the others eat over the rim of his pot. Pharaoh squatted at the very edge of the shifting light from the campfire, hunched over, shadowy face almost stuck right into her bowl, staring around suspiciously and shoving food in with her fingers like she was worried it might be snatched away any moment. Luthar was less enthusiastic. He was nibbling daintily at a wing with his bared front teeth, as though touching it with his lips might poison him. Discarded morsels lined up carefully along the side of his platter. Baez chewed away with some relish, his beard glistening with gravy.
"It's good," he muttered around a mouthful. "You might want to consider cookery as a career, Master Nine Fingers, if you should ever grow tired of—"
he waved his spoon. "Whatever it is you do."
"Ah," said Logan.
In the north, everyone took their turn at the fire, and it was reckoned an honour to do it. A good cook was almost as valued as a good fighter. Not here. These were a sorry crowd when it came to minding the pot. Baez could just about get his tea boiled, and that was as far as he went. Quai could get a biscuit out of the box on a good day. Logan doubted whether Luthar would even have known which way up the pot went. As for Pharaoh, she seemed to despise the whole notion of cooking. Logan reckoned she was used to eating her food raw, perhaps while it was still alive. In the north, after a hard day on the trail, when the men gathered around the long fires to eat, there was a strict order to who sat where. The chief would go at the top, with his sons and the named men of the clan around him. Next came the carles, in order of fame. Thralls were lucky to get their own small fires further out. Men would always have their place and only change it when their chief offered, out of respect for some great service they'd done him, or for showing rare good bones in a fight. Sitting out of place could earn you a kicking, or a killing even. Where you sat round the fire was where you stood in life, more or less. It was different out here on the plains. But Logan could still see a pattern in who sat where, and it was far from a happy one. He and Baez were close enough to the fire, but the others were further than comfort would have put them. Drawn close by the wind and the cold and the damp night, pushed further out by each other. He glanced over at Luthar, sneering down into his bowl as though it was full of piss. No respect. He glanced over at Pharaoh, staring yellow knives at him through narrowed eyes. No trust. He shook his head sadly. Without trust and respect, the group would fall apart in a fight like walls without mortar. Still, Logan had won over tougher audiences in his time. Three Trees, Tulduru, Black Dow, Harding Grimm. He'd fought each one in single combat and beaten them all. Spared each man's life and left him bound to follow. Each one had tried their best to kill him, and with good reasons, too. But in the end, Logan had earned their trust and their respect, and their friendship, even. Small gestures and a lot of time. That was how he'd done it. Patience is the chief of virtues, his father used to say, and you won't cross the mountains in a day. Time might be against them, but there was nothing to be gained by rushing. You have to be realistic about these things.
Logan uncrossed his stiff legs, took hold of the water skin, and got up, walked slowly over to where Farrow was sitting. Her eyes followed him all the way across. She was a strange one, no doubt, and not just the looks of her, though the dead knew her looks were strange enough. She seemed hard and sharp and cold as a new sword, ruthless as any man that Logan could think of. You would have thought she wouldn't throw a log to save a drowning man, but she'd done more than that to save him, and more than once. Out of all of them, she was the one he'd trust first and furthest. So he squatted down and held the skin out to her, its bulbous shadow flickering and shifting on the rough wall behind her. She frowned at it for a moment, then frowned up at Logan. Then she snatched it off him and bent back over her pot, half turning her bony shoulders on him. Not a word of thanks, or a gesture even, but he didn't mind. You won't cross the mountains in a day, after all. He dropped down again beside the fire, watched the flames dancing, casting shifting light across the grim faces of the group. "Anyone know any stories?" he asked, hopefully. Kwai sucked at his teeth. Luthar curled his lip at Logan across the fire. Pharaoh gave no sign that she'd even heard. Hardly an encouraging start. "Not any?" No reply. "All right, then. I know a song or two, if I can remember the words." He cleared his throat.
"Very well," cut in Baez. "If it will save us from a song, I know hundreds of stories. What did you have it in mind to hear about? A romance? A comedy? A tale of bravery against the odds?"
"This place," cut in Luthar. "The old empire. If it was such a great nation, how did it come to this?" He jerked his head over at the crumbling walls and what they all knew lay beyond, the miles and miles of nothing. "A wasteland." Baez sighed. "I could tell that tale, but we are lucky enough to have a native of the old empire with us on our little trip, and a keen student of history to boot. Master Kwai?" The apprentice looked up lazily from the fire. "Would you care to enlighten us? How did the empire, once the glittering center of the world, come to this pass?"
"That story is long in the telling," murmured the apprentice. "Shall I start from the beginning?"
"Where else should a man ever start?"
Kwai shrugged his bony shoulders and began to speak.
"Almighty Eos, vanquisher of demons, closer of gates, father of the world, had four sons, and to each son he gave a gift. To his eldest, Juvens, he gave the talent of high art, the skill to change the world with magic tempered by knowledge. To his second son, Canadius, went the gift of making, of shaping stone and metal to his own purposes. To his third son, Bedesh, Eos gave the skill of speaking with spirits and of making them do his bidding."
Kwai gave a wide yawn, smacked his lips, and blinked at the fire.
"So were born the three pure disciplines of magic."
"I thought he had four sons," grumbled Luthar. Kwai's eyes slid sideways.
"So he did, and therein lies the root of the empire's destruction. Glustrod was the youngest son. To him should have gone the gift of communing with the other side, the secrets of summoning devils from the world below and binding them to one's will. But such things were forbidden by the first law, and so Eos gave nothing to his youngest son but his blessing, and we all know what those are worth. He taught the other three their share of his secrets and left, ordering his sons to bring order to the world."
"Order?" Luthar tossed his platter down on the grass beside him and glanced disdainfully round at the shadowy ruins. "They didn't get far."
"At first they did. Juvens set about his purpose with a will and bent all his power and all his wisdom to it. He found a people that pleased him, living beside the Eos, and favoured them with laws and learning, government and science. He gave to them the skills to conquer their neighbours, and made of their chief an emperor. Son followed father, year followed year, and the nation grew and prospered.
The lands of the empire stretched as far as Ispada in the south, Anconus in the north, the very shores of the Circle Sea to the east and beyond. Emperor followed emperor, but always Juvens was there, guiding, advising, shaping all things according to his grand design. All was civilized, all was peaceful, all was content.
"Almost all," muttered Baez, poking at the guttering fire with a stick. Quai gave a smirk. "We have forgotten Glustrod, just as his father did, the ignored son, the shunned son, the cheated son. He begged all three brothers for a share of their secrets, but they were jealous of their gifts, and all three refused him. He looked upon what Juvens had achieved and was bitter beyond words. He found dark places in the world, and in secret he studied those sciences forbidden by the first law.
He found dark places in the world, and he touched the other side. He found dark places, and he spoke in the tongue of devils, and he heard their voices answer him."
Quai's voice dropped down to a whisper.
"And the voices told Glustrod where to dig."
"Very good, Master Quai," cut in Baez sternly. "Your grip on the histories seems much improved. Let us not tarry on the details, however. We can leave Glustrod's diggings for another day."
"Of course,"
murmured Quai, his dark eyes glittering in the firelight, his gaunt face full of gloomy hollows.
"You know best, Master.
Glustrod laid plans. He watched from the shadows. He garnered secrets. He flattered, and he threatened, and he lied. It did not take him long to turn the weak-willed to his purposes, and the strong-willed against each other, for he was cunning and charming and fair to look upon. He heard the voices always now from the world below. They suggested that he sow discord everywhere, and he listened. They urged him to eat the flesh of men and steal their power, and he did so. They commanded him to seek out those devil bloods that remained in our world, spurned, hated, exiled, and make from them an army, and he obeyed."
Something touched Logan's shoulder from behind, and he near jumped in the air. Pharaoh was standing over him, the water skin held out in her hand.
"Thanks," he growled as he took it from her, pretending that his heart wasn't knocking at his ribs.
He took a quick swig and banged the stopper in with his palm, then put it down beside him. When he looked up, Pharaoh hadn't moved. She stood there above him, looking down at the dancing flames. Logan shuffled up a step, making room. Pharaoh scowled, sucked her teeth, kicked at the ground, then slowly squatted down on her haunches, making sure to leave plenty of space between them. She held her hands out to the fire and bared her shining teeth at it.
"Cold over there."
Logan nodded. "These walls don't keep the wind off much."
"No."
Her eyes swept across the group and found Quai.
"Don't stop for me," she snapped.
The apprentice grinned.
Strange and sinister was the host that Glustrod gathered. He waited for Juvens to leave the empire, then he crept into the capital at Alcus and set his well-laid schemes in motion. It seemed as if a madness swept the city. Son fought with father, wife with husband, neighbor with neighbor. The emperor was cut down on the steps of his palace by his own sons, and then, maddened with greed and envy, they turned upon each other. Glustrod's twisted army had slithered into the sewers beneath the city and rose up, turning the streets into charnel pits, the squares into slaughter yards. Some among them could take forms, stealing the faces of others. Baez shook his head.
"Taking forms, a dread and insidious trick." Logan remembered a woman in the cold darkness who had spoken with the voice of his dead wife, and he frowned and hunched his shoulders.
"A dread trick indeed," said Quai, his sickly grin growing even wider. "For who can be trusted if one cannot trust one's own eyes, one's own ears, to tell friend from foe?" But worse was to come. Glustrod summoned demons from the other side, bound them to his will, and sent them to destroy those who might resist him.
"Summoning and sending," hissed Baez.
cursed disciplines, dire risks, terrible breaches of the first law. But Glustrod recognized no law beyond his own strength. Soon he sat in the Emperor's throne room upon a pile of skulls, sucking the flesh of men as a baby sucks milk, basking in his awful victory. The Empire descended into chaos, the very slightest taste of the chaos of ancient days before the coming of Eos, when our world and the world below were one. A gust of wind sighed through the chinks in the ancient stonework around them, and Logan shivered and pulled his blanket tight around him. Damn story was making him nervous. Stealing faces and sending devils and eating men. But Quai did not stop. When he found out what Glustrod had done, Juven's fury was terrible, and he sought the aid of his brothers. Canadius would not come. He stayed sealed in his house, tinkering with his machines, caring nothing for the world outside. Juvens and Bedesh raised an army without him, and they fought a war against their brother. "A terrible war," muttered Baez, "with terrible weapons and terrible casualties." The fighting spread across the continent from one end to the other and drew in every petty rivalry and gave birth to a host of feuds and crimes and vengeances whose consequences still poison the world today. But in the end, Juvens was victorious. Glustrod was besieged in Alcus, his changelings unmasked, his army scattered. Now, in his most desperate moment, the voices from the world below whispered to him a plan. "Open a gate to the other side," they said. "Pick the locks and crack the seals and throw wide the doors that your father made. Break the first law one last time," they said, "and let us back into the world, and you will never again be ignored, be shunned, be cheated." The first of the Magi nodded slowly to himself. But he was cheated once more. "Poor fool! The creatures of the other side are made of lies. To deal with them is to grasp the most awful peril." Glustrod made ready his rituals, but in his haste he made some small mistake. Only a grain of salt out of place, perhaps, but the results were horrible indeed. The great power that Glustrod had gathered, strong enough to tear a hole in the fabric of the world, was released without form or reason. Glustrod destroyed himself. Alcus, great and beautiful capital of the Empire, was laid waste, the land around it forever poisoned. No one ventures within miles of the place now. The city is a shattered graveyard, a blasted ruin, a fitting monument to the folly and the pride of Glustrod and his brothers. The apprentice glanced up at Baez.
"Do I speak the truth, master?"
"You do," murmured the Magus. "I know, I saw it. A young fool with a full and lustrous head of hair." He ran a hand over his bald scalp. "A young fool who was as ignorant of magic and wisdom and the ways of power as you are now, Master Quai."
The apprentice inclined his head.
"I live only to learn." "And in that regard you seem much improved. How did you like that tale, Master Ninefingers?"
Logan puffed out his cheeks.
"I'd been hoping for something with a few more laughs, but I guess I'll take what's offered."
"A pack of nonsense, if you ask me," sneered Luthar.
"Ha!" snorted Baez. "How fortunate for us that no one did. Perhaps you ought to get the pots washed, Captain, before it gets too late."
"Me?"
"One of us caught the food, and one of us cooked it. One of us has entertained the group with a tale. You are the only one among us who has as yet contributed nothing."
"Apart from you?"
"Oh, I am far too old to be sloshing around in streams at this time of night."
Baez's face grew hard.
"A great man must first learn humility. The pots await."
Luthar opened his mouth to speak, thought better of it, pushed himself angrily up from his place, and threw his blanket down in the grass.
"Damn pots,"
he cursed as he snatched them up from around the fire and stomped off towards the brook. Pharaoh watched him go, a strange expression on her face that might even have been her version of a smile. She looked back at the fire and licked her lips. Logan pulled the stopper from the water skin and held it out to her.
"Huh," she grunted, snatched it from his hand, took a quick swallow.
While she was wiping her mouth on her sleeve, she glanced sideways at him and frowned.
"What?"
"Nothing," he said quickly, looking away and holding up his empty palms.
"Nothing at all."
He was smiling on the inside, though. Small gestures and time. That was how he'd get it done. Chapter 9 Small Crimes.
"Cold, eh, Colonel West?"
"Yes, Your Highness. Winter is nearly upon us."
There had been a kind of snow in the night, a cold, wet sleet that covered everything in icy moisture. Now, in the pale morning, the whole world seemed half-frozen. The hooves of their horses crunched and slurped in the half-frozen mud. Water dripped sadly from the half-frozen trees. West was no exception. His breath smoked from his runny nose. The tips of his ears tingled unpleasantly, numb from the cold. Prince Ladislaw hardly seemed to notice, but then he was swathed in an enormous coat, hat and mittens of shining black fur, no doubt several hundred marks worth of it. He grinned over.
"The men seem good and fit, though, in spite of it all."
West could scarcely believe his ears. The regiment of the King's Own that had been placed under Ladislaw's command seemed happy enough, it was true. Their wide tents were pitched in orderly rows in the middle of the camp, cooking fires in front, horses tethered nearby in good order. The position of the levies, who made up a good three-quarters of their strength, was less happy. Many were shamefully ill-prepared. Men with no training or no weapons, some who were plainly too ill or too old for marching, let alone for battle. Some had little more than the clothes they stood up in, and those were in a woeful state. West had seen men huddled together under trees for warmth, nothing but half a blanket to keep the rain off. It was a disgrace.
"The King's Own are well provided for, but I'm concerned about the situation of some of the levies. You're..."
"Yes,"
said Ladislaw, talking over him precisely as if he had not spoken.
"Good and fit. Chomping at the bit. Must be the fire in their bellies keeps them warm, eh, West? Can't wait to get at the enemy. Damn shame we have to wait here, kicking our heels behind this damn river."
West bit his lip. Prince Ladislaw's incredible powers of self-deception were becoming more frustrating with every passing day. His Highness had fixed upon the idea of being a great and famous general, with a matchless force of fighting men under his command, of winning a famous victory and being celebrated as a hero back in Adua. Rather than exerting a single particle of effort to make it happen, however, he behaved as if it already had, utterly regardless of the truth. Nothing which was distasteful or displeasing or at odds with his cockeyed notions could be permitted to be noticed. Meanwhile, the dandies on his staff, without a month's military experience between them, congratulated him on his fine judgment, slapped each other on the back, and agreed with his every utterance, no matter how ludicrous. Never to want for anything, or work for anything, or show the tiniest grain of self-discipline in a whole life, must give a man a strange outlook on the world, West supposed. And here was the proof, riding along beside him, smiling away as though the care of 10,000 men was a light responsibility. The Crown Prince and the real world, as Lord Marshal Burr had observed, were entire strangers to one another.
"Cold," Ladislaw murmured. "Not much like the deserts of Gurkle now, eh, Colonel West?"
"No, Your Highness."
"But some things are the same, eh? I'm speaking of war, West. War in general. The same everywhere. The courage, the honour, the glory. You fought with Colonel Glockter, didn't you?"
"Yes, Your Highness, I did."
"I used to love to hear stories of that man's exploits.
one of my heroes when I was young, riding round the enemy, harassing his lines of communication, falling on the baggage train and whatnot. The prince's riding crop rode around, harassed, and fell on imaginary baggage in the air before him. Capital! And I suppose you saw it all.
Some of it, Your Highness, yes.
He had seen a great deal of saddle soreness, sunburn, looting, drunkenness, and vainglorious showing off. Colonel Glockter, I swear, we could do with some of that dash here, eh, West? Some of that vim, that vigour? Shame that he's dead.
West looked up.
He isn't dead, Your Highness.
He isn't?
He was captured by the Gurkish and then returned to the Union when the war ended. He joined the Inquisition.
The Inquisition? The prince looked horrified. Why on earth would a man give up the soldiering life for that?
West groped for words, but then thought better of it.
I cannot imagine, Your Highness.
Joined the Inquisition? Well, I never! They rode in silence for a moment. Gradually, the prince's smile returned.
But we were talking of the honour of war, were we not?
West grimaced.
We were, Your Highness.
First through the breach at Ulrioch, weren't you?
First through the breach, I heard. There's honour for you, eh? There's glory, isn't it? That must have been quite an experience, eh, Colonel? Quite an experience.
Struggling through a mass of broken stones and timbers littered with twisted corpses, half blind with the smoke, half choking on the dust, shrieks and wails and the clashing of metal coming at him from all around, hardly able to breathe for fear. Men pressing in on all sides, groaning, shoving, stumbling, yelling, running with blood and sweat, black with grime and soot, half-seen faces twisted with pain and fury. Devils in hell. West remembered screaming, forward, over and over until his throat was raw, even though he had no idea which way forward was. He remembered stabbing someone with his sword, friend or enemy he did not know then or now. He remembered falling and cutting his head on a rock, tearing his jacket on a broken timber. Moments, fragments, as if from a story he once heard someone else telling. West pulled his coat tighter round his chilly shoulders, wishing it was thicker.
Quite an experience, Your Highness.
Damn shame that bloody Bethod won't be coming this way. Prince Ladislaus slashed petulantly at the air with his riding crop. Little better than damn guard duty. Does Burr take me for a fool, eh, West? Does he?
West took a deep breath. I couldn't possibly say, Your Highness.
The prince's fickle mind had already moved off.
What about those pets of yours, those Northmen, the ones with the comical names? What's it called, that dirty fellow? Wolfman, is it?
Dogman.
Dogman, that's it, capital!
The prince chuckled to himself.
And that other one, biggest damn fellow I ever saw. Excellent. What are they up to?
I sent them scouting north of the river, Your Highness.
West rather wished he was with them.
The enemy are probably far away, but if they aren't, we need to know about it.
Of course we do. Excellent idea. So that we can prepare to attack.
A timely withdrawal and a fast messenger to Marshal Burr was more what West had in mind, but there was no point in saying so. Ladislaus's whole notion of war was of ordering a glorious charge, then retiring to bed. Strategy and retreat were not words in his vocabulary.
Yes,
the prince was muttering to himself, eyes fixed intently on the trees beyond the river.
Prepare an attack and sweep them back across the border.
The border was 100 leagues away. West seized his moment.
Your Highness, if I may, there is a great deal for me to do.
It was no lie. The camp had been organized, or disorganized, without a thought for convenience or defense. An unruly maze of ramshackle canvas in a great clearing near the river, where the ground was too soft and had soon been turned into a morass of sticky mud by the supply carts. At first there had been no latrines, then they had been dug too shallow and much too close to the camp, not far from where the provisions were being stored. Provisions which, incidentally, had been badly packed, inadequately prepared, and were already close to spoiling, attracting every rat in Angland. If it had not been for the cold, West did not doubt that the camp would already have been riddled with disease. Prince Ladislaw waved his hand.
"Of course, a great deal to do. You can tell me more of your stories tomorrow, eh, West? About Colonel Glockter and so forth. Damn shame he's dead," he shouted over his shoulder as he cantered off towards his enormous purple tent high up on the hill above the stink and confusion.
West turned his mount with some relief and urged it down the slope into the camp. He passed men tottering through the half-frozen sludge, shivering, breath steaming, hands wrapped in dirty rags. He passed men sitting in sorry groups before their patched tents, no two dressed the same, as close to meager fires as they dared, fiddling with cooking pots, playing miserable games of damp cards, drinking and staring into the cold air. The better-trained levies had gone with Polder and Croy to seek out the enemy. Ladislaw had been left with the rump, those too weak to march well, too poorly equipped to fight well, too broken even to do nothing with any conviction. Men who might never have left their homes in all their lives, forced to cross the sea to a land they knew nothing of, to fight an enemy they had no quarrel with, for reasons they did not understand. Some few of them might have felt some trace of patriotic fervor, some swell of manly pride when they left, but by now the hard marching, the bad food, and the cold weather had truly worn, starved, and frozen all enthusiasm out of them. Prince Ladislaw was scarcely the inspirational leader to put it back, had he even been making the slightest effort to do so. West looked down at those grim, tired, pinched faces as he rode past, and they stared back, beaten already. All they wanted was to go home, and West could hardly blame them. So did he.
"Colonel West!"
There was a big man grinning over at him, a man with a thick beard wearing the uniform of an officer in the King's Own. West realized with a start that it was Jallanhorm. He slid down from his saddle and grabbed hold of the big man's hand in both of his. It was good to see him. A firm, honest, trustworthy presence. A reminder of a past life when West did not move among the great men of the world, and things were an awful lot simpler.
"How are you, Jallanhorm?" "All right, thank you, sir. Just taking a turn round the camp, waiting."
The big man cupped his hands and blew into them, rubbed them together.
"Trying to stay warm. That's what war is, in my experience. A great deal of waiting in unpleasant conditions. A great deal of waiting, with occasional moments of the most extreme terror."
Jallanhorm gave a dry grin.
"Something to look forward to, then. How are things on the prince's stuff?"
West shook his head.
"A competition to see who can be most arrogant, ignorant, and wasteful. How about you? How's the camp life?" "We're not so badly off. At some of these levies I feel sorry for. They're not fit to fight. I heard a couple of the older ones died last night from the cold." "It happens. Let's just hope they bury them deep and a good way from the rest of us."
West could see that the big man thought him heartless, but there it was. Few of the casualties in Gurkhul had died in battle. Accidents, illness, little wounds gone bad. You came to expect it. As badly equipped as some of the levies were, they would be burying men every day.
"Nothing you need. There is one thing. My horse dropped a shoe in this mud, and I tried to find somewhere to fit a new one."
Jallanhorm spread his hands.
"I could be wrong, but I don't think there's a smith in the whole camp."
West stared at him.
"Not one?" "I couldn't find any. There are forges, anvils, hammers, and all the rest, but no one to work them. I spoke to one of the quartermasters. He said General Polder refused to release any of his smiths, and so did General Croy, so, well," and Jallanhorm shrugged his shoulders, "we don't have any." "No one thought to check.
Oh!
West felt the familiar headache tugging at the back of his eyes. Arrows need heads, blades need sharpening, armor and saddles and the carts that haul the supplies break and need to be repaired. An army with no smiths is little better than an army with no weapons. And here they were, out in the frozen country, miles from the nearest settlement. Unless...
We passed a penal colony on the way.
Jallanhorm squinted as he tried to remember.
Yes, a foundry, I think. I saw smoke above the trees.
They would have some skilled metal workers.
The big man's eyebrows went up.
Some criminal metal workers.
I'll take whatever we can get. Today your horse is short a shoe. Tomorrow we might have nothing to fight with. Get a dozen men together and a wagon. We'll leave at once.
The prison loomed up out of the trees through the cold rain, a fence of great mossy logs tipped with bent and rusted spikes. A grim-looking place with a grim purpose. West swung from his saddle while Jallanhorm and his men reined up behind them, then squelched across the rutted track to the gate and hammered on the weathered wood with the pommel of his sword. It took a while, but eventually a small hatch snapped open. A pair of grey eyes frowned at him through the slot. Grey eyes above a black mask, a practical of the Inquisition.
"My name is Colonel West."
The eyes regarded him coldly.
"So?" "I'm in the service of Crown Prince Ladislaw, and I need to speak to the Commandant of this camp."
"Why?" West frowned, doing his very best to look impressive, with his hair plastered to his scalp and the rain dripping off his chin.
"There is a war on, and I do not have time to bandy words with you. I need to speak to the Commandant most urgently."
The eyes narrowed. They looked at West for a while, and then at the dozen bedraggled soldiers behind him.
"All right," said the practical. "You can come in, but only you. The rest will have to wait."
The main street was a stretch of churned-up mud between leaning shacks, water trickling from the eaves, spattering into the dirt. There were two men and a woman in the road, wet through, struggling to move a cart laden with stones up to the axles in mush. All three had heavy chains on their ankles. Ragged, bony, hollow faces, as empty of hope as they were empty of food.
"Get that fucking cart shifted!"
the practical growled at them, and they stooped back to their unenviable task. West struggled through the muck towards a stone building at the far end of the camp, trying to hop from one dry patch to another without success. Another dour practical was standing on the threshold, water running from a stained oilskin over his shoulders, hard eyes following West with a mixture of suspicion and indifference. He and his guide stepped past without a word and into the dim hall beyond, full of the noise of drumming rain. The practical knocked at an ill-fitting door.
"Come in."
A small spare room with grey walls, cold and smelling slightly of damp. A mean fire flickered in the grate, a sagging shelf was stacked with books. A portrait of the King of the Union stared regally down from one wall. A lean man in a black coat sat writing at a cheap desk. He looked at West for a while, then carefully put down his pen and rubbed at the bridge of his nose with an inky thumb and forefinger.
"We have a visitor," grunted the practical.
"So I see. I am Inquisitor Lawson, Commandant of our little camp."
West gave the bony hand the most perfunctory of squeezes.
"Colonel West, I am here with Prince Ladislaw's army. We are camped a dozen miles to the north."
"Of course. How might I be of assistance to His Highness?"
"We are desperately in need of skilled metal workers. You run a foundry here, correct?"
"A mine, a foundry, and a smithy for the manufacture of farming tools, but I fail to see what..."
"Excellent. I will take a dozen or so men back with me, the most skilled men you have available."
The Commandant frowned.
"Out of the question. The prisoners here are guilty of the most serious crimes. They cannot be released without a signed order from the Archlector himself."
"Then we have a problem, Inquisitor Lawson.
I have 10,000 men with weapons that need sharpening, armor that needs mending, horses that need shoeing. We might be called into action at any moment. I cannot wait for orders from the Archlector or anyone else. I must leave with Smith's, and there it is.
But you must understand that I cannot allow...
You fail to realize the gravity of the situation,
barked West, his temper already fraying.
By all means, send a letter to the Archlector. I will send a man back to my camp for a call.